The cool temps have settled into the middle of the country. It feels more like October 8th than September 8th. But weird things can happen with the weather at this time of the year, just like weird things can happen with the markets or the crops. You know what? You just need to be prepared for anything at this time of the year.
Live from a Monday kind of Tuesday via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Dr. Charles Shapiro from the University of Nebraska and Nebraska farmer Debbie Borg. Then we've got Brian Split from AgMarket.net. In the final segment, a word from the Red Cross from Greta Gustafson. And right after the news, Sonia Begeman, seeds and production editor for Farm Journal. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
Jeez, I feel like you just broke a rule or something, Davis.
What? How's that? Already?
Well, you can't say Monday on the Tuesday after Labor Day, or it just like automatically screws you up for the whole week.
I did something unexpected and wonderful on Monday yesterday.
Wow.
Let's talk about that Monday. I watched some golf on TV with my dad. We sat and watched golf.
Yeah.
And I realized I am not cut out to be a golf commentator. Can I give you, I was thinking, if I was a golf commentator, I would say something like this. And he's pulling out another shiny stick to propel the recreation orb into the mode part of what would be some really great pasture land, but is totally going to waste here. Oh, yes. And he hit it really good that time. I would be worthless as a commentator. These guys are fantastic. Unbelievable broadcasters. They put me to shame.
I don't know if they could handle delivering the ag news on AgriTalk. Okay? So let's keep that
Thank
in mind.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. A little perspective. I needed that. I was thinking I needed to change careers or something.
No, warehousing, maybe. You're good. You're good.
Oh, thank you.
Speaking of the news, let's get to it.
Well, as you said, temperatures dropped below freezing across portions of the Canadian prairies and northern U.S. plains overnight, with temperatures dropping to the 20s Fahrenheit in Saskatchewan and ranging from the upper 20s to low 30s Fahrenheit in eastern Montana and northwestern North Dakota. That's according to World Weather Inc. Cold conditions, Chip, are expected to end the growing season and cause some damage to immature crops, with additional frosts and freezes expected farther to the south tonight and Wednesday. But there's a belt of heat that's just kind of south of us, right? Scraping the south end of Iowa and then southward from there. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, I mean, there's a sharp line right there that's causing the rains in Iowa this morning. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, Senate Majority Leader. Yes, go on.
I was just going to say real quick, the 6 to 10 day that was released yesterday afternoon for the 15th through the 21st has still got the below normal temperatures in for Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, and points to the east.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will try this week to offer up a scaled down $500 billion stimulus plan with the White House support. Only half of what the GOP offered at the end of July, but McConnell is struggling to get Republicans fully behind it as newly energized fiscal hawks in the party balk at adding to the estimated $3.3 trillion fiscal 2020 deficit. Speaking with Fox News on Sunday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin called the smaller measure targeted, saying, quote, "I hope by the end of the week we can begin moving forward with that."
Yeah, long ways apart. Long ways apart between Pelosi and Mnuchin. And again, I don't recall a time, and I could be wrong on this, and I should stop saying it, but I just don't recall a time that the House Speaker has spent this much time negotiating with the Treasury Secretary. It seems off to me.
Right. Well, President Trump raised the prospect of decoupling the Chinese and American economies and warned that if he is not reelected, quote, China will own this country. Meanwhile, China's exports gained momentum in August as countries gradually recovering from coronavirus lockdowns, including the United States, snapped up more Chinese-made goods. And finally, this one's sliding under the radar, but it's an interesting point. The economic effects of closed schools could equal those of a small to mid-sized recession, researchers now say. About 4.3 million workers will have to stop working unless they find other childcare arrangements. Mm-hmm. That's according to research from Brevin Howard Asset Management. That's what I've got for you this morning. We need to get over to Sonia. She's got big stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, the economic impact of the shutdowns and the stay-at-homes and all of those orders, it's the economic impact. I mean, it's difficult to say this, but it's been underestimated. And it continues to be underestimated.
I agree.
Think about the economic impact of some of these college towns that aren't going to have tailgating and football.
It
blows me away. It's huge. Sonia Begeman is the seeds and production editor at Farm Journal. How you doing, Sonia?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm missing football too, though.
Yeah, well, we've got a game this weekend. I'd just soon be down in Ames for it, but we do have a game this weekend. So, yeah, I'm excited.
We get to watch it, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, bean leaf beetles at this time of the year, what in the heck is going on?
All right, so first of all, what's going on is, you know, this isn't a totally abnormal time for hatch to happen. I was talking to Isaac Ferry this morning, which is Ken Ferry's son, another brilliant agronomist. And, you know, we're used to seeing some hatch. What's weird is just how much we're seeing. These populations are huge, especially throughout Illinois. It could be something related to the really mild winter that we had. They just didn't, you know, freeze and kill off some of these eggs. Something happened to create this just really massive population, unlike what we've seen before. And Ken and some of his scouts are reporting seeing 30 to 40% defoliation, which if you look at a soybean and see that much defoliation, it basically looks like there's nothing there. So it's pretty massive.
I've seen some of the pictures. It's scary as heck.
It is. And what's really troubling about this is, like, right now is pot fill time. You know, we're in that R5 to R7 growth stage in a lot of states right now. And you need that photosynthesis. You need to capture that sunlight to make sure that you can actually get a full pod. And just not going to happen. If you're down 40%, especially, you're not going to get nearly that pod fill that you're hoping for. So it is a little troubling. So definitely be out there scouting is kind of the main thing you're doing right now for sure.
Okay, so you go out there and you find this heavy infestation. Is there anything that you can do at this time of the year?
There is. I think the first thing you want to do is you can actually use right now, if you're in that R5 to R6 growth stage, and you can go online to figure out, you know, exactly where you're at. Mm-hmm. If you're in that growth stage, you can use hail damage charts that kind of tell you, okay, I'm this much defoliated. This is what it means for yield at this time of year. And so you can compare your yield loss versus, you know, what you could gain by possibly stopping some of this damage. In addition to that, you're going to want to see, you know, what is the cost of treatment? If I'm at that R7 stage right now where, you know, the value of the leaf is not nearly as great, so they're going to be switching over to pods. You don't want to be eating your pods because that hurts your storage. And if you're growing seed beans, that's a really big deal. So you've really got to kind of balance, like, what am I losing in terms of quality, in terms of yield, versus what's the cost of this treatment. It's not, you can treat, there's no one size fits all answer, unfortunately. You got to really just do some of your own research and balance out that cost versus benefit.
Sonia, the guys in Illinois were really proud of the bean crop over there this year for good reason. How widespread is this?
Talking to Isaac this morning, he says it's everywhere. It just depends where you're at in terms of how bad it is.
Does this raise some vulnerabilities for disease post-feeding?
So that was one thing I thought was really interesting. Isaac told me this morning, we're not worried about disease as much. It's that taking away the photosynthesis that we're really worried about. So don't worry as much about disease. Really just keep an eye on how are we going to get those pods filled? Do we have the sunlight that we need?
Excellent. Sonia, your input on this is outstanding. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
You bet. That's Sonia Begeman, seed and production editor at Farm Journal. We're going to be talking conservation, right? Next on AgriTalk.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Hey, welcome back to AgriTalk, everybody. Glad that you could join us today. Farm Journal Field Days is over, but you can still visit all of the sessions at agweb.com/fielddaysondemand. Just to give you a taste of what's there at Field Days, I talked with Growth Energy CEO Emily Score, and I asked her what the environment looks like for biofuels in 2021 and beyond.
The big question mark is what administration is in place, because that's going to take the conversation in very different directions. If you have Trump in place, the conversation is going to be maybe more about octane.
Yep.
And if you have Biden, it's going to be more about climate and greenhouse gas emissions. Again, either way, we have a good story to tell. We've got to be engaged. We've got to keep our policymakers sharp and our champions. We got to make sure they continue to champion.
Hey, yeah, that was a great conversation with Emily. So make sure that you go and check that out. You can see all of the field day sessions at agweb.com/fielddaysondemand. And thank you for joining us for the best of Farm Journal Field Days, brought to you by a channel and the new hashtag Growing Ahead initiative sponsored by Bayer. Follow at Channel Seed on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to see how local teams have gone virtual to keep delivering solid agronomic advice. All right, let's get to the conversation and bring these conservationists online here. Dr. Charles Shapiro from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. How are you, Charles? It's good to talk with you.
I'm doing great. It's a little cooler than normal, but I'm doing okay. We're getting a little rain. We needed rain around here.
Yeah, certainly did. And I think there's even a little bit of snow out in the far western part of your state, isn't there?
That's what they're saying. I'm on the eastern edge, so yep. I don't see anything.
Yeah, and Debbie Borg, Borg Farms in, I believe it's in northeast Nebraska, right, Debbie?
You are correct, and we're pretty wet, and we're just thrilled.
Yeah,
we're up to 8 tenths right now.
8 tenths, wow. Wow. You know, over the Labor Day weekend, I don't mean to rub this in, but we had missed rain after rain after rain here in my spot in northeast Iowa. And over the Labor Day weekend, we picked up a couple of inches of rain. So as you said, very, very thankful to be getting the moisture. Hey, America's Conservation Ag Movement is a national partnership designed to help all U.S. farmers more rapidly scale the adoption of conservation agriculture and its economic and environmental benefits to farmers and their communities. And we're going to continue the conversation about that right now with Dr. Shapiro and with Debbie. I want to start with Dr. Shapiro. How are we doing? U.S. farmers in Nebraska, are the conservation efforts that have already taken place, are they making a difference?
I think there are. You know, change comes slowly, and what we have to do is look at perspective over 10-year periods, not 1 year up and down. But I think the adoption of reduced tillage over the last 30 years has been in the right direction, and use of cover crops in the last 10 years has increased. So as you know, the educational effort, demonstration, research results get more widely known, I think we'll get even more adoption.
Yeah. Which one do you feel, Dr. Shapiro, and I know that it's hard to say, you know, no-till adds more than cover crops or vice versa, I don't know, but what do you think is helping farmers make the greatest advancements?
Well, I like to think of location as important. So somebody, you know, who has a very highly erodible area, I would certainly think that reducing tillage would make the biggest difference right away. Most people, I think, consider tillage the first hill to climb and then fine-tune it with cover crops. But it really depends on your fields, what you've been doing, whether you have conservation structures in place, your history, what your rotation is. So it's hard to describe, but the tillage is very important because that protects the soil a lot of the year, and then it allows the cover crops to do their thing when you add them to the system.
Gotcha. Debbie, I've been following your story for a while. You Borg Farms was one of the early adopters to no-till, right? I mean, 30 plus years ago.
Yes, and I'll have to admit that I wasn't here that long ago. My husband and I just celebrated 25 years. But yes, they were early adopters. You know, not only with no-till, they were the first farmers to have a cab on their tractor. Okay. So, you know, no-till seems old to me because it's what I've always seen here. But I like to share the story that I'm from Colorado, where they do a lot of tillage. And so I can relate to the guys who aren't used to doing it, because at first it's hard to look at.
Mm-hmm. It certainly can be. Debbie, I remember in the late 70s, we had We had a white no-till planter with a very, very low serial number on it. And so my family was in on it very early as well. And you're right. It's kind of a hard hurdle to cross that first year because of you're used to seeing that nice seed bed out there, and it looks a lot different.
It really does. And I have to say, the first time I saw it, I was just like, oh my gosh, how do these farmers leave it like this?
Right.
And now, you know, going back to Colorado, it just pains me to see the tillage because, you know, they're doing three passes on their farm sometimes. And it's like, oh my gosh, what a waste. Don't you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So Debbie, when farmers come to you let's say that somebody comes to you and says, Debbie, give me the best idea that you've put to work on your farm. What do you tell them?
I really believe it's no-till because it's one of the easiest things to do. I mean, it reduces your labor, it reduces your fuel cost. But as Charlie said, it's not a short-term thing. And I want to say this is all, you know, we're in a marathon training that it's year after year. And so you're not going to, it's not going to happen in 1 year. And I do think, you know, between year 3 to 5, it just depends. There might be a little bit of pain. But once you get over that, there's just so many benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Dr. Shapiro, plenty of people in the conversation that think the problem, however they define that problem, that it can be fixed faster with regulations and penalties instead of voluntary and incentivized programs. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say, you know, we have a lot of laws about things and people still break those laws. And, you know, you have to change what's between the ears of people. Like Debbie was talking about, looking at a field, it used to be that our aesthetic was that black soil was beautiful in the springtime and you didn't want to see any stubble. But as a trained agronomist, I've been able to accept that looking at corn stover or soybean stover, I see the protecting of the soil. So my view of what's beautiful has changed. So I think in the long run, we need to change our minds. And that comes, you know, I'm not a missionary, but you change the heart and soul of each individual one at a time. And then once they incorporate that into their thinking, you don't need laws and regulations.
Right. Boy, you got that right. Debbie, on the manure management, talk about how that has maybe changed your conservation and nutrient runoff plans.
So we feed cattle here, and we're also close by a very large chicken facility. So our family's been using chicken manure when they used to give it away because nobody wanted it.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Because now it costs more than commercial fertilizer. And so there are increased regulations. And so we are working with the firm that's all they do for us is make sure we have the right permits. You know, we're soil sampling and testing things, but there are, you know, the regulations on manure management has increased significantly.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Shapiro, you've mentioned the education and changing hearts and what's between the ears. What's the next step? What's the most important next step on doing that?
Well, we have to change the minds of, you know, everybody in society. I think there's some places that are vulnerable so that maybe through incentives and cost share, we can protect with border strips or buffer strips. And so recognition that, you know, each piece of ground has to be looked at for its value and limitations. And that's going to take, you can't expect a farmer to, you know, do all that on their own. It has to be a joint process. And I'm on this Nebraska Healthy Soil Task Force that's going to have a report by the end of the year. And they're coming up with suggestions for Nebraska on how to tackle this in a logical way over a number of years.
Okay, very good, very good. Guys, I want to say thanks for coming on AgriTalk, talking conservation with us. We always appreciate it. That is Dr. Charles Shapiro from the University of Nebraska, Debbie Borg, Borg Farms in Northeast Nebraska. Thank you so much, guys. Go to agweb.com/ ACAM to learn more.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer Senior Market Analyst Jeff Wilson. Jeff, corn market made a run at last week's highs in the overnight. Soybeans spiked through that 975 area, but now we've backed off a little bit. What's going on?
I think the big story is we just have Wall Street continuing its sell-off from last week. It's been tide is rising for the last 3 months in the stock market. It's helped to put more of a bullish incentive into these grain markets. And then we got the CFTC report on Friday that shows yes. the funds are now long the corn market for the first time in more than a year. And that was a big surprise. So you had that stock market sell-off. So, you know, some of the people that got long the corn decided, hey, maybe we better be careful ahead of the USDA's supply and demand and first field-based crop estimates on Friday.
Right, right. Yeah, just the simple fact that the funds have gone, have liquidated that short position or covered that short position, and that's all we got. That's a little disappointing, isn't it?
It's a little bit disappointing. I mean, I think the thing that's interesting, too, is that the soybean net long position is now 163,000 contracts, mm-hmm. futures, and options. That's the most bullish view at this time of the year since 2012. So the market's loaded up with some longs. It needs to have a little profit taking or whatever, you know, positioning ahead of that report on Friday. We do got some rains around, and, you know, even though it's a little late, it may not help corn at all, but it could give beans just a slight boost. But overall, there's a firm tone.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Okay, a little bit of strength in live cattle and feeder cattle, some mixed trade in lean hogs. Jeff, you and I will have a conversation about the markets this afternoon on AgriTalk. Talk to you then.
Sounds. Take care.
All right, that's Jeff Wilson, Pro Farmer.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. The truth is hard to come by these days, unless you listen to AgriTalk.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Got Davis Michelson with me.
Hello.
And we are joined now. I bet this guy had to set an alarm. Mm-hmm. to get up and, mm-hmm. and get ready for the morning show since he's usually on in the afternoon. But I wanted to get a little bit of flavor for this Friday's reports and figure out how to prepare for them. So I got one of the best guys I know at it, Brian Splitt from agmarket.net. How you doing, Brian?
Chip, I am fantastic. It's cool and wet. You can feel spring in the air. It's hoodie season, so I'm ready.
Cool. Cool. It does feel all of a sudden it's starting to feel like football season, isn't it?
Well, it is football season, so
yeah.
There you have it.
There you have it.
No, I didn't have to set my alarm this morning because I do have a job where I have to be awake, and it also happens to keep me up sometimes at night as well. So
right.
It was a good move last night, and see what we get the rest of the day here in the markets, but.
Yeah. Yep. What do you got there, Davis?
Well, I was just going to say, Brian, you strike me as a guy who's up at like 4:30 a.m. doing push-ups like for an hour every morning anyway. You know what I mean? Like just never lets up. So I wouldn't imagine that you would even have an alarm clock.
I believe that's Jocko Willink. That is not Brian Splitt. Close.
Points awarded nonetheless.
Yeah. So, okay, Brian, for years, the October crop production report from USDA was kind of the, boy, look out, here it comes. I think some of the changes that they made to the report process last year moved the marquee of the crop production reports from USDA from August to September, because the September report is the first time that we're getting results from the objective yield plots out there. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're right. So then we have to look at where the market sits right now and what we've dealt with over the last several weeks. So we know that for corn, we have really yet to be able to get through this July high. And we did see the December contract last week tick through it by a little bit. You're still finding resistance there. So, you know, we've priced in the heat that we had in August, those that string of 90-degree temperatures, the lack of moisture. We've seen a lot of buying last week. We started the week with two consecutive nearly 600,000-ton sales of corn to China. And so with all this being said, we've yet to really be able to get through these levels. So I guess the question then is, when we made highs in early July, what were we pricing in? And part of that mechanism was the reduction in acres that the USDA gave us at the end of June. But also a lot of the meteorological community was talking about potential for hot and dry in July. And so we didn't waste any time. We priced in both reduction in acres and probably a potential loss of production based on a hot and dry forecast that really just did not come to fruition. But then it did come to fruition in August.
Right.
So the way it seems to me is that these highs that we've been making have, I think, priced in the loss of the crop, whether it was from the storm that came across Iowa, the flash drought that came across Iowa and spread into parts of the Midwest. We are losing yield, so the crop has gone backwards. But I know that the USDA, as we get into this report, the expectation is that they're going to lower yield. Are they going to lower yield enough to make us push through these highs? Or have we set ourselves up for another potential buy the rumor, sell the fact type of reaction at this resistance level? So I do think that if the market does pull back from this report, that we're likely to go fill that gap at that 345.5 level. But I think that'll probably be a buying opportunity. And part of that is because we believe that there's going to be some strong disappearance on the quarterly stock report at the end of the month.
Yeah.
So while this report that's coming right at us at the end of the week probably will be bullish in the respect that production will be lowered, we probably will also see a reduction in corn for ethanol. So I don't know if the carryout number on Friday is going to be what we need to see to break through these highs. But take another 200-400 million bushels off of that number, which I think will happen at the end of the month. And now we've got a new quarter starting in October with potentially some bullish information that I think can push us through resistance. And so I think October could be a very good month to the upside for corn. And if we just go up through these highs in the short term because the report on Friday is bullish enough to break through, then that's fine too. But I think all in all, the audience base would like to see higher values for corn, and I think that's where we're headed in the big picture.
Okay, interesting. Historically, Brian, and I'm glad that you mentioned the stocks report at the end of the month, because that stocks report does have a history of being a market mover. What about the production estimate that we get in September? How much of a market mover has it been in the past?
Well, a lot of times this September report gives us a sense of, and maybe this is more so in the last several years, of just how big the crop is, where we then have an idea of maybe what the worst case scenario is. And then we put in some lows in early September and then start to work our way higher into some kind of a rally into October. So it seems to me like we're about a month ahead of that schedule. We actually bottomed in August, because I think at that point the forecast for weather then suggested that yield number was probably the worst case scenario. And as we went through the rest of August, after that August WASDE report, we dealt with weather that was taking the crop backwards, not moving it forwards. So I think the lows have been scored about a month earlier than they normally would have. But traditionally, this particular report is kind of, hey, this is probably the biggest the crop is going to be. And even if it's not, the bulk of the yield increase is probably already priced in. Now, for soybeans, I think we've done a lot different market here in August. We've gone through the July highs. We've tacked on a substantial value above the July highs, another roughly 65 cents. I think some of the buying last night was based on the expectation for cold, whether it gets enough of the production area to really matter or not. That's yet to be seen until the actual event happens. But our focus right now as a firm is really getting set up for some cash flow, making sure that we're using this rally in soybeans to get enough cash flow to get us through fall, through the winter. And the lack of carry in the bean market right now offers a lot of opportunity, if you want to go out and put on some conservative ownership on paper with some options.
Yeah. Yeah, because the structure of the market right now in soybeans, we're back to the take it from the combine to the truck to town instead of taking from combine to truck to the bin. There's just not much storage incentive in there, is there?
No, this time last year, the year before, and the year before that, we were working on pricing in 50-cent carries the last 2 years and 40 cents the year before that. So with only 10 cents of carry from November to July right now, it does offer the opportunity to sell out of the field, get your cash flow needs met, and then put a conservative, maximum risk type of a position in July options. And that way, you've got that position all the way until next June. If we have a setback in the market, you can buy back your sold call, open up the upside for next summer. And if things really set back and this ends up being the high for the marketing year part two, right? We had some highs in January, so we've gotten within about a nickel of those highs on last night's high. If you end up selling a good amount of your cash and the market pulls back significantly, you're going to feel like you're in a pretty good spot.
Yeah. So risks in front of the reports that we get on Friday. On last Friday, I put out kind of a warning with Davis. We were just talking. The process of the production estimate, since it's the first time that we're getting the objective observations from those bean fields, and based on what we saw on Crop Tour, on the Pro Farmer Crop Tour, we know those pod counts are solid. I'm a little concerned that we're a month away. Even after that dry August, Brian, I'm a little concerned that we're a month away from getting the kind of yield estimate on soybeans that the market is looking for. I'm thinking that it's going to come in above expectations. To me, that's a risk.
I think you're very right there. The crop has an awful lot of potential. How these pods fill out is yet to be seen. But we've been actually looking at 2013 as a very similar year. And I believe you, and before our segment, it was mentioned that the fund position in soybeans is the largest at this time of year since 2012. Well, the second largest before this year happened was in 2013. And that was a year where the conditions dropped precipitously during the month of August for the same reasons. It was very dry. And if you look at actually when the fund started buying, it was August 10th. That's the same day that we bottomed the bean market this year. So we've rallied about the same period of time. And I have that same concern that maybe the USDA isn't going to lower yield on soybeans as much as they might over the next couple of months. So this may be the first step. But what happened in 2013, and by the way, we're holding a pretty aggressive fund long right now, they did back that position off. And it backed off to about early November, and then they added to it, and they got even more long going into the end of the year. So I could see this market taking a break. We do have some downside targets to hit. This bean market's been moving in 50-cent chunks. And so now that we're poised up against these highs, up against this 980 area, I really think that it's 50 cents in either direction. If we break through 980, I think we're going to go to 1020 to 1030 very quickly. Okay. But a failure up at these levels, I think, will lead down to a test of 920, and that can happen very quickly as well.
Brian, fantastic stuff, man. Thank you so much for coming on the morning show. Help everybody get ready for those reports on Friday. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
All right. That's Brian Splitt from agmarket.net. Check him out at agmarket.net. We're going to be talking about preparedness for disasters coming up next.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize the Nature Conservancy for its efforts to help farmers build healthier soils and a more resilient agriculture system. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
And he's hit it into the deep hole with sand. Looks like he gets an extra 2 points on his score. That's going to help him in the end here.
Davis, I don't think that's how this works.
I don't know how any of this works. Let's all clap quietly.
We used to make up the rules to golf too, Davis. We'd go out.
What might those rules have included, Chip?
Well, there was some Calvin and Hobbes involved in our rules. Okay. You know, like if it was a hot day and your shot ended up in the shade, okay, stroke didn't count.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, so because punitive that's just
measures,
smart.
Yeah. Right.
That's just smart. No, that's not punitive.
What about cloud shade?
That's advantageous. Yeah. Cloud shade? No. Cloud shade didn't work. No. It had to be some sort of foliage providing the shade.
I still think that those acres would be better served with sheep on them. I really do. And I know the good professor would agree with me.
Yes. Yeah, no doubt. All right. Let's, Davis, it's always good to be prepared. We know that, right?
Oh, but, 1,000,000%. Yeah.
But some people are professionals at being prepared. And here's one of them, Greta Gustafson from the American Red Cross. Greta, it's good to talk with you. How are you today?
Doing good. Thanks so much for having us on today, particularly during National Preparedness Month.
Right. To me, it's an intriguing thought because you always, personally, I feel like I'm prepared for a storm like we had in Iowa, the derecho. I feel like I'm prepared for that until you get caught in the middle of it. And worse yet, until your in-laws, your mother-in-law, father-in-law, your parents get caught in the middle of it. And that's when we find out just how unprepared we might be.
You're exactly right. I mean, I feel like it's one of those things that we all have a little bit in the back of our mind, but taking that time to actually sit down and talk with those loved ones, whether it be, you know, a parent, a grandparent, an in-law, and determining what you're actually going to do during a disaster can make all the difference. Again, like you said, it's something you might think about, but really putting those plans in place and having those supplies on hand in advance can make a huge difference for an event like we did see in Iowa a few weeks ago.
Yeah. So I always think that when we're talking about the elderly, the older population, the thing to be most prepared with is you got to make sure that you've got the water. You've got to make sure that you're ready for the electricity to go out. But Greta, I think one thing that I learned during all of this was that maybe you've got to get your parents prepared for the idea that it's time to leave this house for a little while and go someplace where there is electricity.
That's right. And that's why we actually recommend having two different types of emergency kits. So okay. Having that one where you stock up water in your house, you have some of those non-perishables on hand, but also having what we call a go kit. And that's going to include some emergency supplies that you can just grab and go. So still having that extra water, but also having some of those important documents on hand, maybe an extra charger for your phone. And during COVID-19, definitely making sure that you have, you know, an extra mask, some hand sanitizer, all of that sort of stuff, you know, on hand, ready to grab and go, so you can quickly leave if you're told to evacuate.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so what's the, this is going to sound pretty boilerplate, but I'm interested from Red Cross's point of view, which is more important? The preparedness to stay at home or the preparedness to hit the road?
You know, both are equally important. But I think the biggest thing to remember is that if you are told to evacuate, go. If officials are telling you that your area that you're in is no longer safe to stay in, you want to make sure that you are ready to go. You're ready to hit the road. You've talked with those loved ones. Are you able to go to someone's house to stay, or making sure that you have, you know, a couple resources for how you can get information on open shelters? But having that evacuation plan along with that kit is just going to really allow you to act quickly in an emergency.
You know, we're talking about getting the older population prepared for storms, disasters, whatever it might be. But it sounds like pretty good advice for everyone.
That's right. I mean, we definitely recommend that everyone gets prepared. Talk with your kids about it, too. So they kind of understand and what to expect if an evacuation should occur. But for those older adults in particular and those parents, grandparents, talking with them in advance about, you know, what some of their specific needs might be. So if they have a walker or if they have an eyeglass prescription, making sure that they have that kind of in their plan if they're evacuating too.
Yeah, and medications. I don't know if you can even stockpile on a lot of the medications, but you've got to have some kind of a supply ready for that.
That's right. I mean, that's just another good thing to talk with your doctor in advance about. If you do have a notice event, are you able to go into the pharmacy and get a couple a longer day's supply of prescriptions? And that's all part of this preparedness efforts that we're encouraging people to think about this month. So give your doctor a call, get an understanding of what sort of medications that you can get in advance in case
Greta, do you have
you
something?
Won't be able to get them for a bit.
Do you have a checklist available for people that want to get prepared?
We do. So check out redcross.org/olderadult. That's going to be all the information you need right in one place.
Outstanding. Give us that website one more time.
redcross.org/olderadult.
Got it. Greta, thank you so much. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
All right, that is Greta Gustafson from the American Red Cross. We're trying to do more with the American Red Cross. I mean, they're such, it's they've got such great information that everybody needs to know that we're trying to do more with them, and we'll be doing more with them. Thanks for listening this morning. You got to come back this afternoon. Like I mentioned earlier, Jeff Wilson from Pro Farmer. Tomorrow morning, we've got Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa. I got the hunger for getting into something.